Now we turn to the 50th anniversary of the Jackson State Massacre. Commemorations are taking place across the country to mark the 50th anniversary of the Jackson State Massacre. Frequently left out of the history books, two students were killed and 12 wounded when 75 state and local policemen opened fire on a dormitory at the predominantly black Jackson State College in Jackson, Mississippi. The police said there was a sniper on the roof of the dorm. That turned out to be a lie. There were no arrests in connection with the killings at Jackson State, although a commission concluded that, quote, the 28-second fusillade from police officers was an unreasonable, unjustified overreaction, a broad barrage of gunfire in response to reported and unconfirmed sniper fire is never warranted, close quote. Dr. Gerald Horn joins us from Houston. Dr. Horn is a professor of history at the University of Houston and the author of many, many books, including Race to Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery, and Jim Crow. Gerald Horn, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me.
Dr. Horn, we did a show on the terrible aggression that was committed against students at Kent State 11 days ago. That was May 4th, 1970. And we made the point at the time that, you know, while Kent State became iconic and well-known by most Americans, at least at the time, certainly at the beginning, public opinion was really, the majority of public opinion was against the students that kind of bought the government narrative for a couple of days, and then that all shifted. Then 11 days later, this other horrible massacre by the state against black students, it got very, very little coverage in comparison and still has very little commemoration today, even though activists and progressives are commemorating it. Anyway, let's just talk first about what happened at Jackson State.
Well, as your intro suggested, there was a murder engineered by the authorities, the Jackson police and the state authorities in the state of Mississippi. I think that we need to put this in a broader context of what was going on at the time. As the Kent State commemoration suggested, there was quite an uproar on college campuses about U.S. aggression in Indochina. And then at the same time, this was exacerbated by the fact that there had been historically an assault on historically black colleges and universities, of which Jackson State is a premier example. Recall that during the same period, you had the attack on students in Orangeburg, South Carolina, at South Carolina State University. Recall that just before that, you had a similar sort of shooting involving an attack on a dormitory at Texas Southern University, which is a historically black university in Houston, Texas. By the way, as part of the legacy of Jim Crow, it's literally right across the street from the University of Houston, which is quite remarkable in this day and age. And then I think it's important to point out that these historically black colleges and universities were under assault because they were seen, perhaps correctly, as hotbeds of dissent at Howard University within walking distance of your studio. You saw a premier example of that, Stokely Carmichael, in some ways a godfather of this concept and theory of black power. He came out of Howard University and from there went south, where he was hooked up with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And I should also mention that Mississippi has a uniquely terrible record. It's probably, I think, fair to say, outstrips its premier challengers, including Alabama and Georgia and Louisiana, as being the heart of darkness with regard to the suppression of civil rights and civil liberties. Recall that it was in the mid-1950s that Emmett Till, the black youthful teenager who came to Money, Mississippi from his home in Chicago, and was lynched after some sort of encounter with a Euro-American woman at a store. The lynchers came to his bed in the middle of the night, dragged him from his bed, and tortured, mutilated, and killed him. Recall that a few years after that, the field secretary of the NAACP, Medgar Evers, was slain in his driveway by a racist terrorist. And it took years to bring that particular perpetrator to justice. Recall as well that at the University of Mississippi in Oxford, there had to be federal troops sent there to make sure that James Meredith, the first black student to enroll at that college, at that university, was not mauled by his fellow students and others. And recall as well that until quite recently, the mascot, the symbol of the athletic teams of Ole Miss, as it calls itself, was a Confederate soldier. That is to say, a Johnny Reb dressed up in the garb of a soldier who fought the U.S. government to perpetuate slavery forevermore between 1861 and 1865. So all of this is the backdrop, it seems to me, for this heinous killing that took place, or killings, I should say, that took place at Jackson State University.
That's the voice of Dr. Gerald Horn. Dr. Horn joins us from Houston, Texas. He's a professor of history at the University of Houston, the author of many books, including Race, the Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. Gerald, you're making the point that Mississippi even outstripped Alabama, even outstripped Georgia in terms of its notorious violence and racism. And when you think about it, there was the Schwerner, Cheney, Goodman killings in the early 1960s that became such a sort of a landmark for the civil rights movement. And then you had Ronald Reagan show up in that little town, Philadelphia, Mississippi, which would have been an odd place to start a presidential campaign in such a small town. And Reagan was going around saying, "The South shall rise again." And he picked that place to announce his campaign in 1980. I know many of us felt at the time that it couldn't have been more obvious why. And soon as Reagan was elected, there was a wave of KKK mobilizations. As a matter of fact, I was in Georgia and I was in multiple places in Texas where you are doing anti-Klan organizing at that time in the early 1980s. But it's really something that even though the United States sort of treats the long, dark heritage or legacy of apartheid racism and violence and lynchings and the police state in the South as something in the distant past, something that was horrible but has been overcome. Then you have people like Ronald Reagan starting their campaign there using the slogans of "The South shall rise again," et cetera. And here we are, 2020, similar kind of demagogy.
Well, you are correct. Recall that, sadly enough, during that period in 1964 when the three civil rights workers disappeared and then were found in an earthen dam. And by the way, their murder was perpetrated by an unholy alliance between the state authorities and the Ku Klux Klan. And in some ways, there was really no distinction between and amongst them. Recall that when searching for their bodies, and this is one of the more eerie and macabre aspects of this tragedy, the authorities, that is to say the FBI, found other bodies of Black people who had disappeared and had never been heard from again. It'd be interesting to do a study of how many bodies they came up with. And in that regard, in the interest of full disclosure, I should point out that my roots are in Mississippi. Both of my parents were born in Mississippi before they migrated northward to St. Louis, Missouri. And I grew up on a steady diet of horror stories about Mississippi and how terrible it was. But with regard to Reagan, I think it's important to focus on that August 1980 speech in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers were murdered. And it's interesting to point out that subsequently, the conservative neoliberal New York Times commentator David Brooks said that there is no record or no taped record of that speech. You only have newspaper accounts, which is quite curious. But in any case, it represented an olive branch to the most backwards, retrograde elements in the Deep South. That is to say, the retrograde elements in the Deep South for years had been clamoring, saying that there should be a doctrine of states' rights, that the federal government should not interfere and intervene in the affairs of the so-called sovereign state of Mississippi, as it happened with regard to the desegregation of Ole Miss in the early 1960s, or as had happened in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957, when President Eisenhower sent federal troops there to desegregate Little Rock Central High School. And he sent federal troops there basically to prevent the Black students, the Little Rock Nine, from being mauled. And so basically, Mr. Reagan was sending a message that the Black people would be fair game in Mississippi and in the South going forward. And obviously that message resonated because, as you know, for the past half century or more, there has been a stunning example of cross-class collaboration in Mississippi and throughout Dixie, whereby 9 out of 10 Euro-Americans across class lines have voted for the GOP. They're expected to do the same thing again in November 2020 in the midst of a pandemic that's led to the deaths of thousands. This is an amazing representation of allegiance to backwardness. And in that category, Mississippi has few, if any, peers. I would also be remiss if I neglected to mention that these legislators from Mississippi, I'm speaking of Senator James Eastland of Mississippi, who, by the way, the presumptive Democratic nominee for president, Joe Biden, spoke glowingly of him only months ago, which, of course, got him into hot water. He hasn't done so since then. But both James Eastland and his fellow senator, John Stennis, were two of the major supporters of apartheid South Africa. They were two of the major supporters of the racist regime in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, which tried to secede from the British Empire in 1965 because London was moving towards African majority rule and independence. And like in 1776, rather than accede to that decision, they decided to kick out London so that they could perpetuate a racist tyranny, which they were able to do until 1980 when Zimbabwe came to independence. I should also mention in terms of this litany that even though it did not take place in Mississippi per se, a prelude to the racist terror to which Mr. Reagan paid some sort of allegiance in 1980 was what took place in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1979, shortly before Mr. Reagan's remarks, where you had shot down in plain view were these anti-Klan demonstrators who were protesting against the reign of terror that the Ku Klux Klan was perpetrating. And I'm afraid to say you can probably still find the footage from those murders. So this is the backdrop for the killings that took place in Jackson, Mississippi some decades ago.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. We're remembering today the 50th anniversary of the massacre of students at Jackson State in a historically black college in Jackson, Mississippi. Dr. Horn, I want to read a couple of things. This is the New York Times from May 15th, 1970. Jackson police fire on students is the headline. Two persons were killed and 12 wounded early today after the police opened fire on a women's dormitory at Jackson State College here. 15 students were carried out of the dormitory after the shooting. It was not determined immediately whether they had been wounded or cut by flying glass. A heavy, concentrated barrage of gunfire lasting 7 to 10 seconds was directed at the building. Students in front of the building dropped to the ground to take cover. The police said they returned fire after someone had shot at them. Now, let's think about the context, because here's another article that same day in the New York Times. Because you were aware and alive and politically active at the time, and many of the people listening to the show will have been born later and might not know the sort of the context for this and what was going on in the country. I want to read a little bit from this other article, May 15th, 1970, New York Times. The headline is "Police Battle Protesters." The police used gas yesterday on students at the Ohio University at Athens and at the University of Maryland campus in College Park. They broke up rock and paint throwing session at Indiana University and battled with demonstrators at Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti and at Illinois State University. Despite these incidents, however, the nationwide anti-war protests seem to have abated. Representatives of 250 colleges and universities met at Yale to plan constructive anti-war activities to replace that part of the student demonstrations in the last 2 weeks that have been violent. As for those who support President Nixon on the war, New York City construction workers called off a parade and rally in Lower Manhattan today. Instead, they will stage a giant rally in front of City Hall next Wednesday, which they promised would be peaceful. Well, of course, those building trade unions or construction workers in New York were carrying out very, very violent assaults en masse against anti-war protesters in New York City. But the imagery isn't far amiss here, Dr. Horn. With the expansion of the U.S. war into Cambodia, which triggered the protests at Kent State and elsewhere on May 4th, 1970, the American people learned that the Nixon administration had secretly, illegally invaded another country and sent tens of thousands of troops that had been fighting in Cambodia. And the colleges and high schools and communities were erupting in massive protest. And it was clear that the country was sort of moving almost into a state of political civil war because of this imperialist aggression in Vietnam. And young people were going into the streets. And then when they were shot down, as they were in Kent State, the country erupted into another wave of protests. It didn't lead to like a silencing of those protests. Instead, they got even larger, broader, more profound. It's really important 50 years later to remember how the events in Southeast Asia and the events on the home front with the struggle for Black freedom, for Black equality, for Black liberation had sort of created a situation where there was this radicalization that was taking place from a big part of the American population demanding justice at home and justice abroad.
You are correct in that analysis. I should point out as well that students were not only acting in a humanitarian and anti-imperialist manner, which of course they were doing, it was also enlightened self-interest, because at that particular moment there was a draft. You could be conscripted to go to Indochina to fight and perhaps die. I should also mention that this war in Kampuchea, as it was once called, now Cambodia, was a so-called secret war, but unfortunately was not a secret to the people of Indochina. And in fact, that devastating, diabolical war helped to destabilize Indochina, particularly Cambodia, and led directly to the rise a few years later of the genocidal Khmer Rouge, who, as you know, will live forever in infamy because of the genocide they inflicted on the people there, not unlike the Rwanda genocide of 1994. And I have to say, of all of the events that you mentioned, one of the most startling was the March on Wall Street of these so-called hard hats, mostly Euro-American working-class people, proletarians, if you like, who were marching in favor of the war, marching in favor of Richard M. Nixon, and along the way, beating up anti-war protesters, beating up any people who had long hair, beating up anyone who seemed to be dissenting from the status quo. This is a staggering, stunning, and remarkable event that really merits more attention, not only from historians, but for those seeking to understand this current phenomenon of Donald J. Trump. Now, with regard to the student protests, you mentioned the number, but I would have to single out the student protests in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, because I recall in particular a student protest that took place in the streets of Washington, a stone's throw from your studio, that hampered the ability of the Secretary of Defense to get to the White House to plot bombing runs in Indochina. And that is one of the reasons why the protests in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, at Howard University, at the University of Maryland at College Park, at American University, at George Washington University, were taken so seriously by the authorities. Because then, and I would also say now, the protest there has the ability to gum up the works, to basically bring the war machine to a halt. And that is a lesson that I dare say current contemporary students should take and study very seriously.
Dr. Gerald Horn is our guest. Dr. Horn is the author of many, many books. I have two of them on my desk, Dr. Horn, that I have read both of them, and I want to recommend them to our audience. The one is The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism, The Roots of Slavery, White Supremacy, and Capitalism in 17th Century North America and the Caribbean. Another book I recently finished, also excellent, which I think people must read, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance, and the Origins of the United States of America. Gerald, back at that time in 1970, I was high school age. I know I was with other kids my age. We organized a protest after Kent State. The next 2 days later, about 5,000 high school students came out. That was going on all all around the country when people were being drafted, as I was then drafted a little bit later in 1971. When I came to the draft office for my physical, I was handing out the newspaper of the American Servicemen's Union, the Bond, which was an anti-war GI paper. And about half the people were very angry at the Selective Service, and they would be dismissive or spit on you or whatever. But the other half were very like, yeah, this is good. We like this. It was very divided. And these were the people who were going into the Army, presumably, right? 50% of them were sort of like cool with it. And the year after Kent State and the year after Jackson State, when there were more massive protests all around the country, very notably, they were led by GIs. They were led by U.S. service members who had come back from Vietnam. And they were Black GIs, they were Latino GIs, they were white GIs. They were in the forefront of the anti-war movement. In fact, in many of the demonstrations, which became even more militant, I would say 15, 20% of the participants were American returned soldiers. It also was that was a significant part. You were mentioning about how the demonstrators tied up Washington, D.C. The soldiers being drawn into the movement, especially Black soldiers who were in many ways the vanguard of the GI resistance movement, it made it really impossible for the war to continue as it was continuing. Let's just talk about how this intersection between the civil rights movement, anti-racism, anti-war, and GI resistance. Again, all of the students, all of the young people were very close to that because of the system of conscription. Let's talk about that if we could.
Well, a reigning symbol of that era is the late heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali. Recall that it was in 1967 he refused to step forward on religious grounds to accept being enrolled in the U.S. military, and thereby was barred from the sport in which he earned a living for a number of years. But instead, in order to keep his family afloat and keep food on the table, Muhammad Ali went around campuses, he gave speeches, eventually he became an actor. But the bottom line is that he became a symbol for anti-war dissidents and became a hero that in some ways basically transcended the sport of boxing. Another interesting example from that era is a person who's still with us. I'm speaking of Jane Fonda, the actor, who of late has been campaigning against U.S. Lethargy with regard to addressing climate change, not least in Washington, D.C. But at that time, she was an anti-war activist, subsequently derided as, quote, Hanoi Jane, unquote, because of her anti-war activism. And one of the things she did was help to organize so-called coffee houses, which oftentimes were outside U.S. military bases, such as in Fort Ord, California. And these coffee houses became seedbeds for anti-war resistance within the military itself. And I should mention it in this context. These sailors on these battleships, these naval vessels, oftentimes were sailing the high seas for days and weeks at a time. And there was frequent conflict between the rank and file, particularly Black sailors, and, of course, the officer corps. One of the many reasons why the United States had to withdraw ignominiously from Vietnam in 1975 was not only because of the heroism of the Vietnamese themselves, but also because the U.S. military machine, in some ways, was becoming dysfunctional. It seemed, if these vessels are any example, that these sailors spent as much time fighting each other as they did fighting the Vietnamese. And I think, once again, that kind of anti-war activism and organizing is something that's desperately needed today as we see this failed attempt to overthrow the Maduro regime in Venezuela and what's been referred to contemptuously as the Bay of Piglets, a play on the Bay of Pigs of 1961, an attempt to overthrow the Castro regime in Cuba.
That's Dr. Gerald Horn. Gerald, we have about 3.5 minutes. I'm glad you mentioned what's happening right now. I mean, when you think about it, we're in the middle of a severe pandemic. Nobody knows where it all ends. The U.S. government really badly mishandled, I would say, was guilty of criminal negligence and malfeasance in the way it did not prepare for or prepare the people for the crisis. And yet, just in the last 2 weeks, we have The same U.S. government dispatching naval destroyers to the east coast of Venezuela in the Atlantic. We have the United States dispatching naval destroyers under the rubric of freedom of navigation into disputed waters off of China's coast, not off of Long Island. We have all of these examples of militarism and war. We have Mike Pompeo rushing to Israel to work with Netanyahu to formalize the annexation of the West Bank before the November election. It says so much about the country, addicted to war, addicted to militarism, so sort of dripping with imperialism from every pore. And so while there was this massive movement against the war in Vietnam, the system hasn't changed. The movement has declined. But again, movements go up and they go down. Certainly the problem is pretty much the same problem. Anyway, we have about 2 minutes left.
What our discussion over the last few minutes has revealed is that to the extent this movement has declined, and certainly it has since the heyday of 1970, when you had Jackson State students in the streets protesting, it's because of the male fist of repression. It's because of the authorities shooting into dormitories at Jackson State University in response to demonstrations. But the situation today might even be more dire, believe it or not, not only because of the pandemic, but also because of this new Cold War that's erupting between the United States and China that's taken on very dangerous dimensions in terms of U.S. naval vessels sailing close to Chinese territory in the South China Sea, in terms of this very sharp, underreported skirmish that took place between Indian and Chinese troops on their border just a few days ago. Of course, India is part of the Quad, that is to say, United States, India, Japan, and Australia, that's seeking to encircle China. At the same time, Japan just inked an increase in their military budget, while Australia has angered China by calling for an open-ended investigation of the virus that apparently erupted in Wuhan. And China says that this is not the time to address that issue, which has not gone down very well in Canberra, Australia. So we also know that Mr. Trump, in order to bolster his fading reelection possibilities, wants to keep the focus on China rather than his own ham-fisted, incompetent approach to resolving this pandemic, which has led to the United States being number one in terms of infections and also in terms of death. So certainly we need a resurgence of that kind of activism that we have been discussing, the kind of activism that brought students into the streets of Jackson, Mississippi, that brought students into the streets of Kent, Ohio, and Washington, D.C., and elsewhere.
I agree with you 100% on that, Dr. Horn. Again, on May 30th, there will be another round of nationwide car caravans demanding cancel the rents. These will be taking place in cities and towns throughout the United States. The American people can't pay their rents. More than 35% of them did not. The government is spending $1 trillion a year on war, death, and destruction. It certainly can bail out renters and people who have mortgages that they can't pay. The movement for social justice and for peace, intertwined movements, need to come back, and I believe are coming back. We were joined from Houston by Dr. Gerald Horn. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston. He's the author of many books, including Race, the Revolution, the U.S. and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, The Apocalypse of Settler Colonialism. Look for his books, must reads. Anyway, we are completely out of time. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.